Bonjour. Je suis heureux d'accueillir le plus jeune intervenant dans notre série de séminaires, Jaden Katz. Le département de biologie des systèmes à Harvard a une bourse qui est accordée à des chercheurs qui sont inhabituels et pour effectuer des recherches sans être associés à un particulier laboratoire. Ils sont free agents. Ce sont des positions pluriannuelles et généralement utilisées pour une transition vers une position académique, une carrière académique. Et Jaden possède une de ces bourses. Il a obtenu son doctorat au MIT, dans le département des sciences du cerveau et cognitif, où il a effectué des travaux expérimentaux sur les protéines qui se lient à l'ARN et leur fonction dans les cellules souches et la détermination du destin cellulaire. Il a également travaillé sur la neurogénèse et sur les approches informatiques pour détecter la régulation des isoformes des protéines au niveau de l'ARN M. Il a nourri des intérêts de longue date dans l'informatique théorique, la programmation, la logique et les mathématiques. Et depuis qu'il a rejoint notre département et en tant que fellow, il revient à ses intérêts qu'il a développés au cours de ses années universitaires. Jaden est également un citoyen engagé, un commentateur prolifique et un penseur sur les aspects importants pour la société. Tout en travaillant dans notre département, il a également été boursier et maintenant affilié au Berkman Center for the Internet and Society à Harvard, où il a étudié les implications du brevetage sur la science universitaire, sur la science académique, en particulier dans le domaine biomédical, et où il a mené une étude sur les inégalités de financement public en sciences et ses causes. Jaden est fondamentalement un scientifique motivé par la curiosité, qui est une espèce en danger d'extinction. L'effort actuel de Jaden consiste à traduire sa compréhension des phénomènes de cognition, d'apprentissage au niveau cellulaire, c'est-à-dire à considérer la cellule comme une machine d'apprentissage. Edgar Dijkstra, l'informaticien, a une fois plaisanté que la question de savoir si un ordinateur peut penser n'est pas plus intéressante que la question de savoir si un sous-marin peut nager. Et en cela, il a fait écho à Alan Turing, je crois, qui pensait que l'utilisation des mots et l'opinion générale instruite changeront tellement que l'on pourra parler des machines pensantes sans attendre d'être contredit. Ça n'a pas changé, je crois, encore. Il est trop optimiste, Turing. Mais nous pourrions remplacer machine par cellule, et c'est ça que peut-être Jaden nous expliquera maintenant.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to Walter for the kind introduction. Even with my very poor French, I can tell that was a very kind introduction. So my talk today will have two parts. The first part will be a history, a very brief idiosyncratic history of this idea of cells as cognitive creatures, an idea I'll make precise as we go along. And the second part will be a concrete example, an exploration of cells predicting the future or instantiating probabilistic inference by cellular biochemistry. Okay, so cells as cognitive creatures for me is both an idea and it's also an attitude. So it's an idea that says that cells, even single-celled organisms such as microbes, predict, perceive, and act in their environment in a very complex way, not unlike the manner in which animals with brains behave and predict and perceive their environments. And it's an attitude because it requires, I think, openness to concepts such as memory, learning, representations when we talk about cellular behavior. Now, you can think of it in contrast to other ideas, other viewpoints. One of them is this one. This is a view that says that cells are actually just reactive automata. They react to what's immediately present in front of them. And anything interesting or adaptive actually happens on a much slower evolutionary timescale, the timescale of random mutation and selection. So you can think of that as a kind of opposing viewpoint to the idea of cells as cognitive creatures. So let me tell you where I'm going with this. So my main points for today are, one, that viewing cells through a cognitive lens is an old idea. It's been there for a long time. It's sometimes on the margins of scientific practice. This idea or attitude, if you embrace it, invites alternative interpretations of experimental data, and it can also guide potentially new directions of experimentation. But this idea and attitude also raises very foundational questions about cognition and computation, epistemic and philosophical questions, which I'd like you to keep in the back of your mind. Questions such as, are organisms really best seen as computing or so-called information processing machines? Are these adequate metaphors for biology? How does biological computation compare with traditional computers? Do organisms represent their world or their environment? And if so, where does this representation lie? And finally, what is the relationship between this abstract stuff, like information processing, and the real material biological body? And these questions will come up throughout the presentation. Okay, so part one is a brief history, some sort of snapshots from this very messy history of the idea of cells as cognitive creatures, cells doing cognitive things. So I wanted to start with American physiologist Herbert Spencer Jennings, who's named after the famous Herbert Spencer. So Jennings did a study called the Behavior of the Lower Organisms in 1902, where he studied a very impressive array of behaviors and a very impressive array of organisms. He looked at how organisms such as amoeba and ciliates forage, how they find food, and how they react to a variety of stimuli. So he would poke them, he would heat them up, he would spray chemicals on them, and he would study their behavior under a microscope. Now, crucially, is the behavior that he observed took place on the timescales of seconds and minutes. So, of course, way faster than anything we would call evolution or genetic evolution. So he would look, for instance, at how amoeba can chase their prey around for as long as 15 minutes under the microscope, and how it looks like very directed motion. And he was very captivated by this behavior, and he wrote, the writer, meaning Jennings, is thoroughly convinced that if amoeba were large and were present in our everyday experience, its behavior would at once call forth the attribution to it of states of pleasure, of pain, of hunger, desire, and the like, on precisely the same basis as we attribute these things to a dog. He also did some famous experiments with the ciliate organism, Stentor roselli. So this is a very interesting organism. And what Jennings decided to do is to attack it. So he took a pipette with a bunch of carmine beads and he splashed them onto the organism. And he noted a very stereotyped reaction. First, the organism would sort of bend away to try to get out of the stream of beads. Then it would sort of alter the direction of its the cilia on its mouth in order to reverse the direction of the beads. Instead of flowing into the mouth, they would flow out of it. If you kept pestering it, it would contract and eventually it would roll away. And what Jennings argued is that if you continually attack this organism, eventually, you keep spraying these beads, eventually the organism would go from its resting state to a contraction state. So the organism would sort of learn or anticipate, this is a very bad scenario, I better just shrivel up into a ball because it's not a good environment for me. And for many years, Jennings' experiments, particularly these experiments, were discredited and considered to be unreproducible, but actually a paper came out earlier this month, in fact, showing that much of this reproduces. Not exactly as Jennings described it, but many of the experiments that were argued to discredit Jennings actually worked with a different strain of this ciliate. So Jennings did many experiments, and I can't do justice to all of his observations here, obviously, but I would say these are the punchlines. He would say that cells get acclimatized, that was the term that he used, to certain perturbations, like changes in light, changes in temperature, and that the action of an organism at a particular point in time depends on its history, on the history of its past behaviors, the history of stimulation, and on the organism's internal physiological state. And so crucially, Jennings really wanted to persuade readers that this is not a simple function of the stimulus. You can't just say, I provoke the animal with this stimulus, and based on the properties of that stimulus, predict what it'll do next. It's much more complicated than that. And he described phenomena, a general principle, which could be argued to be a kind of learning. He wrote, quote, "The resolution of one physiological state into another becomes easier and more rapid after it has taken place a number of times." So if you think of the ciliate being provoked with beads, the more frequently it goes through these transitions that result in it shriveling up into a ball, the more readily it'll be able to go into that transition in the future. And so Jennings was very happy to attribute intelligence to the organisms that he studied, but he concluded that science can't answer the question of whether they're actually conscious. He said this is too much, but intelligence, that was no problem for Jennings. So I want to fast forward quite a bit to the beginnings of molecular biology, and Jacques Monod and François Jacob embraced in their pioneering work a kind of cybernetic frame, which at the time it was widely believed that cybernetic principles of adaptation and feedback could explain everything from bacterial growth to human learning, and even all the way up, especially when promulgated by people like Norbert Wiener, all the way up to factories and societies. So this idea that cells have potential purpose or behave as if they have purpose and that they're engaging in a very sophisticated adaptive process was, of course, very much present there in the dawn of molecular biology, even if it wasn't explicitly by reference to cognition. And Monod even invoked cellular memory in his writing. Moving on to the 1980s and 90s, there are a bunch of studies by prominent physiologists and molecular biologists like Daniel Koshland, who thought that neurons should be studied together with bacteria, and that this was quite natural to think of an individual neuron in the same breath as a bacteria. So these studies showed that individual neurons in culture get habituated to pulses of stimulation with neurotransmitters, and that they exhibit a form of memory that can last quite a while on a timescale of hours. And for people like Koshland, this was very similar to how bacteria adapt to new concentrations of sugars. He thought the differences were perhaps more quantitative than qualitative, that the neurons have a longer-term memory than the bacteria. In the 1990s and 2000s, there were many people making explicit analogies between artificial neural networks, which at the time were becoming quite popular in cognitive science and computer science, with bacteria. So it was argued by several people that if you look at a signaling network inside a bacterial cell, it looks very much like an artificial neural network, which by extension makes it seem perhaps like a brain. And one of the key similarities, according to this line of work, was that both proceed in parallel. So signaling networks in an individual cell, like a bacterium, are not orchestrated by some centralized machine. There's no orchestra conductor, so to speak, but they're all unfolding concurrently and in parallel. And the same is arguably true for these artificial neural network models. And that was seen as a key similarity. And some people went as far as to argue that there is a phosphoneural network essentially operating inside every bacterial cell, and that a major project for the future would be to outline what kind of intelligent-like behaviors these signaling networks could do. So I have to say, in this very heterogeneous literature relating concepts from cognition and psychology to cells, there's a lot of messiness and there's also a lot of confusion. So as I mentioned, these ideas keep resurfacing in different forms throughout the decades. And so in 2009, there was a big splash in the media from a paper published in Nature. And according to NBC News, these scientists have shown that microbes plan ahead and they predict future events. And this study made the following argument. It said E. coli, of course, aside from living in the laboratory, they also live in the gut of mammals. And this study made the argument that when E. coli travel from your mouth into your gut, they encounter certain sugars in particular order. So they encounter lactose, for instance, before they get to maltose. And so the logic was that if you're an E. coli cell and you're seeing lactose in your environment, you know that maltose is coming up. So you better prepare for it by upregulating the metabolic machinery needed to eat maltose. And what the study showed is that you can actually break this apparent correlation or conditioning relationship between lactose and maltose by evolving cells in a laboratory evolution experiment where this correlation does not occur, meaning cells are grown persistently in lactose, and lactose is not followed by maltose, and then this relationship goes away. When the cells see lactose, they no longer upregulate the maltose genes. But I'm not disputing the results of these experiments, but I am disputing the interpretation. I think this is a case of selection, where you're selecting for a particular architecture where lactose does not trigger maltose, but this is rather different, I would say, from the experiments Jennings did, which are looking on timescales of minutes and hours and do not depend on evolutionary selection. So this is perhaps best thought of as a classical case of selection rather than cells doing conditioning at the cellular level. Okay, so let's come to an interim summary of this history. The dominant understandings of behavior from psychology at a particular point in time tend to be applied to the biological world, which is why we see repeated invocations of concepts such as conditioning and association and habituation, which are mainly drawn from associationist psychology or behaviorist psychology. And that's one theme. And the second theme is that the day's most popular computing paradigm tends to be the metaphor, which is then applied to the biological world or to the bacterial cell or the microbial cell. So when neural networks were very popular in the 1990s, and of course they're popular again now, then that was seen as the right computational framework with which to analyze cellular signaling. Okay, so that was some background, and I want to now transition to a more concrete case study of taking seriously this idea that maybe cells do predict their future, maybe they do anticipate what their environment will look like. And so to do that, I want to take a step back and look at a different stream of cognitive science, a little bit different from the behaviorist stream that we've seen so far. And I want to ask a very broad question. So how do we understand biological information processing systems? And this question was posed by the cognitive neuroscientist David Marr in the 1980s, and he proposed a very famous framework with which to think about this question. He said, look, if you want to understand how a biological system processes information, you have to look at it at three levels of description. The first is the computational level, where you say, what is the task that the system is solving? What are the inputs and outputs of this task, and what makes a correct solution? So this first level is the mathematical characterization. The second level is an algorithmic one, where you say, how is the organism representing the task of interest, and what algorithm or procedure is it using to actually arrive at the correct solution? And finally, the third level is the meat, so to speak. So how is the hardware or the biological machinery giving rise to the algorithmic level? And so Marr was a bit strict about the order of things here. He thought this procedure has to be applied in a sort of top-down fashion. So he famously said, quote, trying to understand perception by studying only neurons is like trying to understand bird flight by studying only feathers. It just cannot be done. You have to first know what is the mathematical or computational problem that the organism is solving, and only then, once you kind of know what you're looking for, can you drill down to the meat, to the biology. Here's an example that Marr gave, just to make this a little bit more concrete, for an adding machine. He said, suppose your organism was a kind of calculator. Well, the first level would be the computational one, and it would be something like the laws of addition, like which operations are associative or commutative. The second level would be the algorithmic one, how you represent numbers. So you might represent Roman numerals, or you might represent your numbers in binary form, and you can easily imagine how different operations are easy or hard, depending on what representation you use. And finally, the hardware level, the meat, is the sort of physical instantiation of this arithmetic process. And here you can imagine using just about anything. It can be electronic, it can be beads on a string, and so forth. So many have criticized this kind of approach for what is often labeled as its rationalistic character, meaning this is a view of organisms or of people that assumes that organisms are just kind of passive observers of their environment, kind of depicted here by this drawing of Caesar perceiving an eagle. So you are an information processing machine as an organism. You're seeing an external reality which is out there. You contemplate that reality through acts of calculation, but you don't actually substantively shape that reality. You are just observing it and making calculations based upon it. The other criticism of this view is that it's kind of fundamentally disembodied, meaning in Marr's framing of things, you can certainly study the abstract computational problem without ever talking about its physical instantiation in anything or its materiality, so to speak. In fact, you're encouraged to do that. You're encouraged to first look at the abstract problem and only then bother with the materials. So I want you to keep these criticisms in the back of your mind as we go along, but let's give this Marr approach a shot when we analyze microbial behavior. But before we get there, I want to just say that this approach has been very popular in cognitive science and in neuroscience, and I want to give you a flavor of how it's been applied to describe instances where people engage in learning and in inference about their environments. This is before we get to the microbial stuff. So this is a very well-known study by Griffiths and Tenenbaum, who are cognitive scientists. And they took a bunch of people, undergrads in an American university, and they asked them to predict the duration of various events in life. So they said to their subjects, if you were assessing the prospects of a 60-year-old man, how much longer do you think he would have to live? Or if you were an executive evaluating the performance of a movie that has so far made $40 million at the box office, how would you estimate its total gross? And so they argue that this is a problem of probabilistic inference, where you have some prior over the duration of the interval. You have some sense of how long certain things take, like you have some idea about the duration of lifespans. And you're seeing some sample from a particular process, like this person is 60 years old, and you have to now give a probability over the duration of this interval. And what they found is that people are actually remarkably good at doing this in a variety of domains. So not just lifespans, but also, or movie grosses, but also predicting the length of a poem. So if you're reading line 3 of a poem, how long is the poem? And also predicting the baking time for cakes, for example. Interestingly, people do mess up. This is a population, as I mentioned, of American undergraduates in university. And people are, this particular subject pool was kind of bad at predicting the reign of a pharaoh, of Egyptian pharaohs. And they did a follow-up experiment where they basically asked people to give their prior. So to ask them, how long do you think a pharaoh's reign is, typically? And what they found is that people's inferences were actually correct. They were just matched to the wrong prior. And that once you correct for that, you get inferences that seem in line with this Bayesian or probabilistic calculation. Okay, so that's very nice, but it's pretty abstract. And the question is, how is this implemented biologically? So how does it unfold in your brain? And these kinds of results have led to a search for the so-called Bayesian brain or the Bayesian coding hypothesis, which states that the brain represents a variety of sensory information in the form of probability distributions, and this is what enables it to do probabilistic inference. And so there's a wide range of neuroscientists and cognitive scientists who are looking for the biological correlates of these probabilistic models. They're looking for signatures in electrophysiological data, for instance, of things like the prior, the likelihood, and the posterior. So I want to take this approach and apply it to our case of microbes, so nothing as fancy as an animal with a large centralized brain. And this is attractive because inference is a very, probabilistic inference of the sort I showed you, is a very precise form of learning. We know what the mathematical problem is, and we can now ask, could it ever be realized within the biochemistry of a single cell? It's question number one. And then question number two is, if we were presented with an organism or a cellular circuit that performed inference, how would we know it experimentally? If it didn't come with a manual, so to speak, how would we know? And I want to explore this in the context of microbes responding to different nutrient environments, because it's a very rich area in which to look at, where a lot is known, at least about the metabolic circuitry and about the biochemistry of what is happening. So it's been well documented that a microbe's history of nutrients, the nutrients it has seen in the past, will affect its response in the future. So for instance, if you take baker's yeast and you expose them to glucose, which is their favorite sugar, they'll grow happily. If you then transition them to galactose, they will stop growing for a while. They'll need to induce this network of genes called the Gal pathway, which are needed to metabolize galactose. And so you'll get a very slow induction of the Gal pathway. However, and this is in similar spirit to Jennings's principle of going through the same motion multiple times, making that motion easier, if you take the cells, you put them in glucose and then galactose and then glucose and then galactose again, you get faster induction of the Gal pathway. So having that switch in your past makes you predisposed to it in the future. There's other evidence for this in E. coli, where you do a similar experiment where you switch cells from glucose to lactose. And here the y-axis is showing the growth rate of the cells in this microfluidic chamber. And so if you start in glucose, cells are growing pretty happily. If you go to lactose, there's a dip in the growth rate because they need to now switch their internal metabolism. And if you go back to glucose, there's a bump. But if you do this multiple times, the cells are able to switch sort of seamlessly between the two. There's also evidence that cells engage in kind of anticipation for future nutrient environments. So building on this famous result of dioxy by Monod, it's well known that cells will eat their preferred sugar first, they'll eat glucose first, and if the other sugar is available, like galactose, they'll first eat the one that they like best and then switch to the other one. But recently it's been shown that different strains of yeast can actually anticipate the depletion of their favorite sugar. And different strains of yeast make this trade-off of when to initiate the alternative pathway differently. So you have, for instance, the procrastinators who are very late to prepare to the alternative sugar. So they'll eat all the glucose, and then when the glucose is just about to run out, then they'll start upregulating the machinery needed to eat the alternative sugar that is there. And therefore, they'll take a hit in their growth. They won't be able to grow smoothly through the transition. But then you have the early preparation strains, which well before their favorite sugar is depleted, they're already starting to upregulate the machinery needed to eat the alternative sugar. And therefore, their transition in terms of growth looks much smoother. So I want to think about this in terms of David Marr's framework, where we can take cellular adaptation to these changing nutrient environments, take that and think of that as a kind of problem of probabilistic inference, where you have a cell, it's being exposed to a changing environment, the cell is building up a model of how that environment evolves, and its main quantity of interest is to predict the probability of a particular nutrient X in the future, given the history of the environment. And the idea is that if the cell could have a model that tells it the probability of a particular nutrient in the future, it could adapt and prepare for it and therefore potentially have a fitness advantage later on. So let's make this more concrete in a particular mathematical setting where we take a very simple changing environment that is governed by a Markov model where you have two states, A and B, which you can think of as two different sugars, two different nutrients. And there's probabilistic transitioning between these two states. And in a Markov model, these transitions can be summarized by just two numbers. One is the probability pi AB, probability of going from state A to state B, and the other one is the probability of going from state B into state A. And with these two numbers, you can completely parameterize the environment, and you can predict, of course not perfectly, but as well as you could, what the environment will be like next. So imagine that we have this model, and this is the model that's driving our environment, and it generates a sequence of perturbations. And you can imagine that we have a bioreactor, let's say, with cells, and we're flowing these nutrients, A or B, based on this model into the bioreactor. And then as the nutrients are being flowed in, so let's say here we start with A at time zero, they're being depleted because the cells are eating these nutrients. So we flow in nutrient A, and then we remove it, and we put in nutrient B, and the cells are eating the thing that we're putting into the bioreactor. And these transitions are governed by this underlying Markov model, which the cells don't know about. So it turns out that if we do a Mahr-style analysis, and I won't go through all the details, but if you do a Mahr-style analysis, there's a very simple representation that you would need in order to anticipate what the environment will be like if it's really produced by a Markov model, and to calculate this quantity of interest, which is the probability of a nutrient occurring in the future given the past history. And so in terms of representation, what you would need is this transition matrix, which is basically a set of counts. So you need the counts of how many times you've transitioned from nutrient A to nutrient B, and you need another count which tells you how many times you've gone from B to A. And these are numbers, these are integers, and you also need to be able to convert these into probabilities in order to make a probabilistic calculation of saying what is the probability of a particular nutrient being there in the future. And so in addition to keeping track, storing these numbers and updating them as the environment changes in real time, you also need this normalization sampling operator, which says I'm going to take these numbers and convert them into probabilities. So how would you implement this at the molecular level? Well, what you would need to do is essentially have a directional counter. And synthetic biologists who wake up in the morning probably don't wake up and say, we're going to implement a directional counter, but the Mahr level theory shown on the previous slide says that this is actually a useful thing to have if you want to adapt to changing environments. So a directional counter would basically keep track of how many times the environment switched from state A to state B. And the way it works is as follows. You have a sensor which in the presence of A becomes activated. And then this sensor molecule then activates another molecule called a B recorder. And in the presence of B, this B recorder gets activated. And then it produces this molecule called A to B. And the abundance of this molecule now encodes how many times the environment has switched from A to B. And by symmetry, you have the same thing for B to A. So you have a sensor, which is sensitive to B, makes a recorder, which is sensitive to A, and that produces another memory molecule called the B to A memory molecule. And so now the abundance of these two molecules encodes how many times the environment transitioned from A to B or B to A. So you might think that this directional sensing is a bit esoteric, but if I can go back to Jennings for a minute, one of his key observations was that, and I'm quoting him, it is the transition from one state to another that is often the cause of the reaction of organisms. So whether you're going from a high to low temperature or low to high, or whether you're going from a particular chemical mixture to another one, the direction seems to matter. So he wrote, it is not mere change that causes the reaction, but change in a particular direction. So maybe it's not so odd after all, and we'll see how this fits in with our circuit for doing inference. So that's a directional counter. The second thing you would need is this normalization sampling operator, which takes these counts of how many times the environment has gone from A to B or B to A, and it converts them into probabilities. Now, the classic algorithm for taking a vector of counts and normalizing it into probabilities is a sequential algorithm that requires iteration through a vector of numbers. And of course, this is highly unrealistic for a biological system in which there are no for loops. As I mentioned, there's no centralized orchestra conductor, so you cannot do this. Things are happening in parallel. So how would you enact this operation of normalization? So it turns out that we're not the first ones to observe this, that concentrations, chemical concentrations, sort of lend themselves into being probabilities. And so the way you can normalize two counts, like C1 and C2, is you can encode the counts in the abundance of two molecules, which I'm labeling here activator and repressor, and you can have these bind in a mutually exclusive fashion to another binding site on a third molecule called the integrator. And what will happen is that if you count the fraction of molecule, integrator molecules that have the activator bound, that'll be proportional to the concentration of the activator divided by the sum of the concentrations. And so by just setting up this circuit, you're getting normalization out of counts, sort of very naturally. And of course, the activator and the repressor, they can bind in parallel concurrently, as is always the case in chemistry, without imposing sequential structure. Okay, so now we have this transition counter, directional counter, and we have this normalization sampling operator, and we can put these together in order to control a gene expression program of interest. So if our environment is changing from A to B nutrients, we want to be able to regulate appropriately the gene expression program that is required to eat A and the gene expression program that's required to eat B. And so it turns out you can do this by just combining these two simple gates that I've shown you. So here we have an integrator molecule here. When it is bound by a memory molecule that encodes the A to B transitions, when it is bound by that, and when that molecule is bound by A, meaning A is present in the environment, then what does that tell us? That tells us that A to B transition has occurred in the past, so B tends to be followed by A, and A is present now, so what's coming next? It must be B. And so this forms a complex, which I'm calling the activator complex, which upregulates the expression program that's needed to metabolize B. You have the opposite with the repressor molecule when it is bound by A, because that means that you're about to go into A in the future and not into B, and so you want to repress the B program. And then again, you have all these symmetries for the B to A memory molecule on the other side. So by just combining these two gates, you can control a gene expression program in proportion to its probability of occurring. So that's the key point. Cells want to upregulate the right metabolic program in proportion to the probability of that nutrient occurring in the future. So we can write this circuit in a language called Kappa, which you've already seen in this course. It's a rule-based language for modeling biochemical systems in a way that respects the fact that rules are local and the fact that the system is inherently stochastic. And so we can take our probabilistic model, in this case the Markov model, and we can produce a set of Kappa rules and then simulate the abundance of molecules probabilistically from this program. So let me show you what it looks like. So this is kind of a complicated figure, so let's just step through it. First, just look at the top. Here we have a periodic nutrient environment where the probabilities of the that govern this environment are as follows. The probability of going from A to B is very high, it's 0.95. And the probability of going from B to A is also 0.95. So that gives you an environment that goes from A to B back to A. And this is what it looks like here. So if cells are exposed to this, let's look at what happens to the gene expression program that they upregulate. So this is shown here in this panel. So initially, you haven't seen anything, and so there's no response at all. But as you encounter a transition from A to B, the A to B counter goes up. And when you see, again, a transition from A to B, it goes up again. And so you can see that this molecule sort of tracks the number of times you've transitioned from A to B. That's the purple curve. The orange curve does the same from B to A. And as you're getting more experience of the environment, you begin to see sharper responses, a kind of anticipatory responses, where as soon as you see the A program, you're already beginning to upregulate B. And even before B is out, you're already upregulating A. And it gets sharper with time because you've accumulated more data, so to speak, and you're more confident that the environment follows this periodic structure as the cell. Now, if you then stop, so here the environment ceases to be periodic, and as the experimenter, I said, enough of that, we're just going to have A, and we're going to let it decay by the fact that cells are eating it. Then you get sort of the wrong behavior, the wrong inference on the part of the cell. They're upregulating B because they think it's coming, but there isn't any B around. I've assumed that these memory molecules, these A to B and B to A, are rather stable. And so that stability determines the dynamics of forgetting for the cell. So if you wait a long period of time, these molecules will eventually decay and you'll be back to zero. It'll be as if you're back to the start here. But if you start perturbing the system again, you'll change the abundance of these memory molecules and you'll get the same anticipatory behavior. Important thing I want to draw your attention to is that if you say, well, where's the probabilistic calculation in the system? The probabilistic quantity of the probability of seeing A in the future is encoded in the very transient assembly of these activator complexes that I've shown before. And so if you plot the fraction of activated A to B complex or B to A, you see that they go in and out. They're formed and disassembled as the environment switches. And so there's not a stable quantity that you can look at naively and say the abundance of this protein stably encodes, let's say, the probability of seeing A in the future. It's not as simple as that. It's more transient and a kind of a moving target, so to speak. So that was for a periodic environment, but of course the whole point of the circuit is that it is plastic, that it's tuned to the history of its environment. So if you choose a very different kind of probabilistic environment where pulses of A tend to be followed by B, but B lasts a while, so probabilistically that means the transition from A to B is very high, but the transition from B to A is comparatively lower, you get environments that look like this. You have A, then you have B, but B lasts a while. Now you're back to A. We know that B is likely to follow, but it's also likely to stay for a while and so on. And now you get a different behavior that's more tuned to the dynamics of this environment. Of course, this circuit is going to be, to state what might be an obvious point, the circuit is going to be limited by the kinetics and the constraints of protein production. So if our sensors of the environment and our molecules that are doing this recording and storage and counting are, let's say, much slower than the time scale of environmental transitions, we're going to miss them. So if you make everything much slower compared to the environment, then of course you're not going to get any adaptive behavior and you're not going to see any case of learning. Similarly, if your environmental changes are on the time scale of years, then of course you're not going to be able to see year-long learning from molecules whose kinetics are in the time scale of hours and minutes. Okay, so that was showing that with relatively simple components, so there's nothing esoteric in what I showed you. These are just ordinary kind of signaling components. You have molecules that bind each other. They bind each other conditionally based on whether they're bound by something else. This is nothing too extreme or bizarre happening. But the question is, if I handed you an organism and I said, figure out how it works, how would you know that it's enacting this kind of computation? So I want to ask this epistemic question for a minute. And I want to point to the limitations of very popular approaches within systems biology for addressing these questions, which are premised around the notion of a steady state, of cells being in a steady state. So here's an example of what I mean by a steady state. This study from 2016 wanted to ask how cells are tuned to the relative abundance of glucose and galactose. And so what they did is they had a reporter for the galactose pathway. So they had a fluorescent protein, a yellow fluorescent protein, that glows when cells are upregulating the galactose machinery. And then they took these cells and they put them in a 96-well dish, and they looked for varying concentrations of glucose and galactose. So they tried all these different combinations and measured the activity of the reporter. And this is the activity of the reporter shown here in this heat map. And what they found is that more or less in most concentration regimes, cells are sensitive to the ratio of glucose to galactose. So that's what the cells are doing. And what I want to ask is, let's suppose we had cells that are sensitive to the history of glucose and galactose, and we took this approach, what would we get out? And we can simulate that by essentially doing this experiment, but not doing it in the lab, doing it on our circuit as if our circuit was an actual organism. So here in this plot, I'm varying the concentration of A and varying the concentration of B, and I'm exposing this circuit to a given concentration, and I'm waiting until the circuit reaches a sort of steady state where the components are not changing anymore. And the heat map shows you the abundance of the B program. So this is the gene expression program that is tuned to B in these different conditions. So what you can see is that if you do that for the B program, and if you do the same experiment, but this time you measure the A and B transition molecule and the B to A transition molecule, they kind of all look pretty similar. There are certainly differences, but the A to B molecule, which counts the number of times you've gone from A to B, and the B to A molecule, which counts B to A transitions, they have very different meaning, very different semantics, so to speak, in the system, but they have kind of similar profiles, and I would argue that these profiles don't lead you into thinking about probabilistic inference. At least it's not obvious how you would go from doing this experiment to postulating something like an inferential process. There's another way to probe this system and to glean the fact that it is actually doing something like probabilistic inference, and that is if you run this circuit in different environments, which correspond to different settings of the probabilities that govern our Markov model, and then you measure the fraction of activator complexes, which, as I mentioned before, encode these probabilities, and you compare the ratios of activated complexes to repressed complexes, compare that to the posteriors ratio, meaning the probability of posterior probability of going from A to B or B to A, you see a fairly decent correlation across a wide range of environments. So what that tells you is that there's some information there transiently, if you know where to look for it, but it's not going to reveal itself from a kind of steady state analysis that simply looks at the relative abundances of A to B molecules. So I started constructing this model using the MAR-level approach, where we started with a computational problem and then we derived the circuit. But I want to actually dwell on a couple of important differences between the circuit that we have now, which is embodied in proteins, and the original problem that we started with, which is an abstract problem of simply inferring the probability of a particular state in a Markov process. So unlike in our computational model, or the MAR-level one, here we definitely have an instance of cells shaping the environment. Why? Because cells are consuming, remember, they're eating the signals, A and B, that they're also modeling. And so if you imagine the circuit being instantiated in a population of dividing cells, then your ability to predict the future would affect your probability to grow, which would in turn affect the probability of seeing nutrients in the future. And so things are coupled in this way where cells are not just passive observers of an environment, they're actually actively shaping it. There's no sharp boundary also in our circuit between inferences and action. So as I mentioned, the activator complexes that are being transiently assembled only come into being when cells need to act in our particular design. So it's only when you're in the state of A that the cell will reveal to you the probability that it thinks B is coming next. And it reveals that probability through the fraction of activated complexes. So action and inference are coupled in this very significant way that is not as cleanly separable as it is in computational characterizations of a problem. There's also no sharp distinction between perception of the environment and the environment's true or objective reality, as I mentioned, because the cells are consuming the signal that they're responding to, as I mentioned, but also the cell's only notion of what's out there or what has been out there in history is the abundance of the memory molecules. So if you were to chemically perturb the abundance of A to B molecules, make it, let's say, higher, it would be as if the cell had been in an environment where transitions from A to B were more frequent. There's no distinction between the real history of the world, so to speak, from the perspective of the cell, and the abundance of that molecule. And finally, returning to this idea of the Bayesian brain, there's no clear molecular knob, I would argue, that corresponds here to something like the prior or the likelihood. There's not one molecular feature that you can tune to say, I'm going to make the prior higher or lower. Things are coupled through the reactions of sensors and activators in a way that is not as clean cut as it is in computational models. In fact, the whole notion of a prior sort of breaks down here because we think of priors in it from a statistical perspective as the probability of reacting in the absence of any data. But there's no such thing as absence of data for cells. They're always in the middle of doing something. They're always responding to the environment. So this, even the very notion of a prior sort of seems a little bit ill-suited for this scenario. So I want to talk about a couple of shortcomings of this analysis, which are emblematic of the shortcomings of the MAR approach. So clearly, cells are doing much more than just predicting the future. From the inside perspective of a cell, one could go as far as to argue that prediction doesn't make very much sense. This is the argument made famously by Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela in their notion of autopoiesis. And the argument, if I can simplify it, is as follows. It's saying people invoke notions like information processing or prediction about cells all the time. But if you think about it from the perspective, the inside perspective of the cell, the overarching constraint is that of autopoiesis, which is remaking of oneself. The cell has to constantly recreate itself and live within the boundaries of its own making, to use Varela's phrase. And this overarching constraint shapes all cellular processes. So you might look at one particular protein and say the abundance of this protein encodes this feature of my model, but clearly the abundance of that protein is subject to a much larger overarching constraint, that of autopoiesis. And so they offered a different way of speaking about biological behavior. They said, imagine you have these cells, they have things in them that we can measure, like a dynamical system that is changing state through time. The cell is interacting with its medium, which is giving it its nutrients, and this system is evolving through time. As long as what they call the structural coupling between the medium and the cell allows the cell to stay intact, you have autopoiesis. And everything else that, that we impose on top of the structural coupling by observing its history is a construction of our own mind. So the famous dictum was anything said is said by an observer. If you say that this cell is in processing information or encoding and decoding information, that's a construction that you're imposing on a particular structural history that you've observed. Sorry, history of structural coupling that you've observed. But from the inside perspective of the cell, it might be quite meaningless. And so if we apply that to this question of, well, are cells really cognitive creatures? Are cells really doing inference? We can take a more Maturana and Varela take on this and say that we have an observer, like a scientist, who is looking at the history of a structural coupling and positing that cells are engaged in inference. And the same observer might posit that these cells are engaging in acts of cognition. But this is purely in our domain, and it's purely an interpretation of a structural coupling that we've observed. And we should be very cautious about looking for the biological correlates of these cognitive constructions because they're subject to a much larger overarching constraint, that of maintaining the cell's unity or autopoiesis. Okay, so I want to just conclude now. This exploration of inference in a biological circuit. So what I hope to have shown is that relatively simple biochemical circuits can realize fairly sophisticated informational or cognitive feats, like predicting what's going to happen next when the environment is probabilistic. And that the Mar-levels analysis, with all of its flaws and its disembodied nature, can nonetheless lead us in the direction of interesting and potentially useful circuits, like the directional counter that I've shown. And so it can perhaps fuel the design of interesting circuits that we can engineer in cells, but we have to be very mindful of the fact the circuit we end up with by doing this Mar-level analysis, if it's really embodied in proteins and constrained by the logic of protein productions, is not going to obey all of the separations and features found in the Mar-level one, this kind of sterile, one might say, computational characterization of a problem, because organisms are not computers. So there are a number of open questions and challenges. We can, of course, say, how is this circuit that I've shown you, like the one that performs inference, how is it integrated in a larger system, a system that has to maintain itself and be autopoietic? As I mentioned, the cell has to do much more than just anticipate the future. It has to also remake itself and divide and so forth. So how would a circuit like the one I've shown integrate within this much larger system? Can these circuits be built experimentally, and what are their properties? And finally, how does this inferential response compare with that of actual microbes that are exposed to these probabilistic but structured environments? So environments that have an element of randomness but also structure. Okay, so now to really conclude the whole thing, this idea of cells as cognitive creatures is an old idea that has taken on many forms through the decades, at least since the very beginning of the 20th century. It's deeply entangled with foundational questions that are philosophical and epistemic about the limits of the metaphors that we apply to ourselves and to cognition, metaphors like computation and information processing, and we should always ask whether these metaphors are relevant and whether they are actually harmful at some points, or whether they blind us to seeing certain things that are of more importance to the organism. And finally, I want to say that these foundational questions reveal themselves even in vastly simpler organisms than the ones we're used to thinking about in the context of neuroscience, like big animals that have brains. And so it's maybe worthwhile to look at microbes more carefully and see sort of the cognitive life of microbes and how far we can take it. So that's it, and thank you very much for your attention. I want to thank the Collège de France for hosting me, and to Walter Fontana in particular for inviting me, and to my collaborators on this work. Thank you very much.